modifying chromosome 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 22, followed by the sex chromosomes. In all, humans had 23 pairs of chromosomes, strands of DNA encoded with genes, made up from 46 individual chromatids. The two chromatids of a duplicated chromosome were held together at a region of DNA called the centromere, giving it the classic X shape. So then, what's this extra chromatid doing all by its lonesome? That 47th chromatid, she informed him, is Salzburg syndrome. Scott's eyes grew wide and his head cocked to one side. Sol's what? Never heard of it. That's because it was only discovered a few years ago by a guy named Alan Salzberg, a brilliant scientist and grade A asshole. Sounds like you know this guy. Mia frowned. I used to work in his lab, but that was before he discovered Salzberg. During my time there, I became obsessed with creating a fully functional human artificial chromosome. When I finally cracked the problem, Alan swooped in and took all the credit. Scott's face squished up. Ouch. And when I protested, he made my life a living hell, and so much more. So much more? Maybe another time, Mia said, feeling that old simmering anger rushing back in. It was sometime after I left that someone in the lab discovered a new and extremely rare genetic disorder. Not surprisingly, they named it Salzburg syndrome, after the guy who probably did next to nothing to find it. You know, this Alan guy sure reminds me of Thomas Edison, Scott said. Saw this brilliant documentary on the BBC not long ago. He ran his fingers through his hair and scratched at his skull. The bloke had a nasty habit of stealing other people's inventions and passing them off as his own. He was a top-notch wanker. Asshole or not, I do have to admit the discovery was an important one, Mia said. Each of a chromosome's chromatids contains either a dominant or recessive version of a given gene. When children are born with an extra chromosome, it's usually because a third copy was made, a condition called trisomy, which leads to conditions like Down syndrome. The difference here is the single Salzburg chromatid isn't a duplicate. The DNA inside of it is entirely new, and no one knows where it came from. Mia eyed the electron microscope display. Thankfully, Salzburg is exceptionally rare, which is probably why it hasn't gotten more attention. Define rare, Scott said, the apple held in his now limp hand. Well, Down syndrome, for example, occurs in roughly 1 out of every 700 births. Salzburg, on the other hand, shows up in about 1 in 10,000. Except, here's the really strange part. Salzburg doesn't only show up at birth. It can appear at any age, like cancer. Sometimes people don't even know they have it. And what about the rest of the patients we swabbed? He asked. That's what has me so confused, she said, shaking her head in disbelief. I found Salzburg in every one of them. She and Scott stood in silence for a moment, pondering what she'd just said. Mia's phone broke the spell. Once again, she reached into her pocket and killed it. His gaze shifted to her pocket. Zoe again? Probably, Mia said, grinning away the many unanswered questions swirling around in her head. Among them, how could a recently discovered and exceptionally rare disorder suddenly be present in huge swaths of the local population? Still uncertain, Mia removed her phone, plugged in her passcode, and glanced down at her screen. She continued to stare for several seconds, her emotions running the gamut from confusion to disbelief. She wondered whether she was dreaming, but the cramps forming in her stomach told her this was no dream. She blinked hard, but the display on her phone never changed. It read, "Missed call, Alan Salzburg." Chapter 9. The descent toward the fissure in the seabed took the better part of an hour. While Nikola operated the rover by tweaking Zeus's thrusters, other members of the ROV team fed the submersible's fiber optic cable and power supply. A third monitored the machine's vital signs. Powerful LED lights on the bow illuminated the surroundings. "Wow, that's quite a gash," Nikola said through his headset as the fault line came into view. "Grant, you notice anything unusual?" Jack asked the biologist, who was with Gabby up in the control room.
"I see a total absence of marine life," Grant exclaimed. "Even the coral has disappeared."
"Assuming it was there to begin with," Jack said. This was yet another reason he made a point of speaking with the local fishermen while out in the field. They were often rich repositories of information on conditions along the ocean floor.
We are now entering the fault line, Nicola announced. 300 meters, a voice from Nicola's team called out. The sheer edge of a cliff face drifted by the camera as the sub continued its descent. This went on for several minutes as the voice rattled off the depth readings every 50 meters. Frustratingly, the ROV's nose had to remain level, at least until they exited the crevasse. When they reached 500 meters, or 1,500 feet, Jack felt his pulse begin to quicken, only barely aware his index finger and thumb were doing a slow, pensive dance. Then the bottom edge appeared. The rover left the wide fissure and descended into an immense underwater chamber. It felt to Jack as though they were entering another world. He recalled spelunking at Grotte di Teulada in Italy and the similar feeling it gave him. Slowly, the roof of this colossal underwater cathedral faded from view, and a new shape began to materialize from out of the darkness. Jack's heart really began to thump a wild beat in his neck.
"Oh boy, would you look at that!" Dag said as it came into view.
A slightly rounded metal tip loomed against the backdrop of marine sediment. Watching the particles whiz past them gave the eerie impression of being in outer space.
"Get in a little closer," Jack told Nicola, who tweaked the ROV joystick between his fingers.
The object was so massive they couldn't see all of it at once. Three Titanics set bow to stern would still come up short. The ROV came to within 50 feet.
"No reflection off the metal," Grant said in amazement, "as though it's absorbing the light."
The ROV was rotating to the left when Anna's soothing female voice came on the line. "Dr. Greer, please angle the camera 10 degrees to the south." Nicola looked at Jack, who nodded for him to comply. The nose dipped. "Closer, please," she said. Once again, Nicola obeyed. "Closer, please," Anna repeated. The ROV was less than 5 feet away. Any closer might risk an impact. There were markings etched into the otherwise smooth hull. They looked like pictographs, maybe hieroglyphics.
"I hope to hell you're recording all this," Jack told Nicola.
Nicola assured him he was. Grant cleared his throat.
"Given no one else looks inclined to admit the obvious, I suppose I'll be the one to come right out and say it. My terminology might be off, but I believe the gents at SETI would call this first contact."
Jack let out a long, shuddering breath.
"What do you make of those symbols?" he asked. "No one in particular."
"Scientists spent decades decoding the Mayan glyphs," Dag said. "Even Anna isn't that good."
"Insufficient data,"
Anna added, confirming Dag's point.
"Duly noted," Jack replied.
They worked their way down the smooth gunmetal surface, a veritable wall of gray. Within less than a minute, the subtle outline of circular seams broke up the uniform finish. There were about 36 of them. They varied in size and were arranged in rows from large to small. Soon, a darker shape appeared on the object's outer hull.
"Whoa, go back up," Jack demanded. "What was that?"
"It went by so quick I didn't get a good look," Grant said.
"Looked like a big porthole to me," Dag offered, uncertain.
Jack thought otherwise, but kept it to himself. The ROV's descent slowed before it began climbing back to the mystery spot. Nicola stopped as soon as the dark object came into view. What they had seen wasn't a window. It was a 3-foot-diameter hole in the hull. Had it been cut? But the edges were perfectly smooth, not ragged the way you'd expect if industrial torches had been used. Besides, it was hard to believe a ship that had potentially crash-landed on Earth without suffering so much as a scratch could be cut by anything known to man. The ROV was drawing a touch closer when it dawned on him. Perhaps the opening had not been from someone cutting their way inside. He thought of the other seams he'd spotted nearby, arranged like missile tubes on a nuclear submarine. Maybe it hadn't been a way in, but a way out. The idea sent cold fingers darting along his spine. Gabby's soft, disembodied voice echoed in his ear. Was it possible she had been right? That this colossal structure was better left in its watery grave as it had been for millions of years? Just then, a real voice cut into the frequency.
"Dr. Greer, it's Billy. The Navy's here."
Jack looked up, alarmed. For some reason, his mind had gone immediately to the Cuban pilot tied to his hospital bed in the rig's infirmary. Had the Cubans shown up to collect their imprisoned comrade? International incidents aside, there was a far bigger reason to be worried, and Jack was staring at it through the ROV's forward-mounted camera. Chapter 10. The MH-60S Seahawk helicopter was already on the landing pad by the time Jack exited the shipping container and climbed the stairs to the rig's upper level. A group of six sailors in tactical gear, their weapons in the low ready position, swept toward him. Following behind them was a self-assured U.S. Navy officer adorned in a khaki uniform and beige cap. In his hand was a silver briefcase. The armed sailors rushed past Jack and down the stairs, splitting off in two directions like water moving around a boulder. "This is a private scientific installation," Jack shouted after them as they sped by. When he swung back around, he found himself face to face with the officer. The Navy man's lips peeled back into a dimpled smile. A molar, capped in gold, winked as it caught a ray of sunlight. Behind him were two other armed men, both dressed differently than the group that had just gone by. "Rear Admiral Thomas P. Stark, Jr.," he said, offering his hand. A silver star was pinned to each pointed collar. Above his left breast pocket sat several rows of colored ribbons, and above that, a golden officer's pin. When Jack failed to return the shake, Stark removed his cap and tucked it under the bend in his arm. His hair was blonde and tightly cropped, like a well-mowed lawn. Average height and weight, he was fit for his age, somewhere in his mid-50s, Jack guessed. "I know why you're here," Jack said, wondering if Stark's men were already plucking the Cuban pilot, Fuentes, out of his hospital bed. Stark's eyes narrowed. "I thought you might. We were the ones who scooped him out of the drink. If the Cubans want him, they can come get him themselves. I have no interest in having my people used as political pawns." "Little late for that," Stark said. Those dimples were back in full force. He held up the briefcase. "Is there any place we can talk?" Jack led them to one of the vacant shipping containers. It had been intended as a lab to study rock samples, but after discovering the object, all that business had stopped cold. He got on his walkie and called for Gabby again. As co-chief, she should be here for whatever was about to take place. By the third try, she finally answered and agreed to come down. The space was tight. Both of the armed men next to Stark removed their helmets. "This is Commander Hart," Stark said. Athletic and deceptively powerful for his size, Hart sported a goatee with twisted edges, reminiscent of a gunslinger from the Old West. The rest of his face had the sun-baked look of a surfer. Stark pushed a few scientific instruments out of the way and placed his briefcase on the table. "And this here is Lieutenant Olson." The two men couldn't have been more opposite. While Hart was average height and wiry, Olson was well over 6'2" and stout. He was also a shade lighter, except for patches around the eyes where he wore his Oakley sunglasses. Unlike Hart, Olson was neatly shaved, giving his face a youthful appearance. "These are Navy SEALs," Stark said, letting the announcement hang in the air. "I know all about the SEALs," Jack said, cutting him off. "When I was a kid, I read everything I could about Kennedy's time in office. For a while, I couldn't decide between a career in the Navy or as a geophysicist." Stark grinned. "No regrets, I hope, Dr. Greer." "Only on days like today," Jack said. He was trying his best to keep cool, but all he could think about was the object they'd seen down below. More than that, he couldn't help wondering what the military would do if they found out. At last, Gabby arrived, swinging open the large metal door. "There are soldiers in the infirmary," she began, before she saw Stark and the others. "The hell is going on here?"
"That's precisely what we'd like to know,"
Stark replied, introducing himself and the SEALs. Gabby shuffled past them and over to where Jack was standing, holding her elbows.
"While this rig might be your office, mine is sailing a few miles from here. It's called the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower, and it's surrounded by an entire carrier strike group. We're in the area on orders from the President, tasked with stopping a communist state from illegally expanding its borders."
"You're talking about Cuba building those artificial islands," Jack offered.
"You betcha," Stark replied. "And who do you think they learned that little trick from? Well, it might work in the South China Sea, but it sure as hell ain't gonna happen in our own backyard. Not on my watch.
So, if it's all the same to you, I intend to take that aviator into custody.
Aviator? Gabby said, confused. Have you been listening to our calls?
Not us, ma'am, Commander Hart said. The NSA.
And if we say no?
Jack replied, wondering why Stark was even bothering to ask, especially given Fuentes had likely been loaded onto the chopper already.
I didn't save this guy so you could use him in some game of international diplomacy.
Fuentes won't be harmed, Stark assured them, collecting his briefcase from the table. But we will be taking credit for the rescue.
Jack shook his head. I don't give a crap about credit.
Thank you both for your understanding, then, and your time, Stark said.
He turned and took two purposeful steps toward the container door, both seals in tow, before stopping.
Oh, there's one other thing.
The muscles in Jack's jaw tightened.
This is a scientific research expedition. We've had no contact with the Cubans, if that's what you're worried about.
No, Stark assured them. But I am worried about this.
He set the briefcase back down, removed a piece of paper, and handed it to Jack and Gabby. It was a graph with a giant spike along the y-axis.
What am I looking at? Jack asked, a feeling of dread creeping up his throat.
A gift. This one from our friends at NASA, Stark explained.
He swung his arm in circles above him.
One of those fancy satellites they have floating around up there, designed to detect gamma ray bursts. You science types probably know more about those than I do.
Also sometimes referred to as cosmic rays, GRBs were high-energy photons originating from outside the solar system, and in many cases, outside the galaxy. Since their discovery in the mid-60s, astrophysicists had suspected GRBs were caused by supernovae, or the collision of two neutron stars. A single gamma-ray photon was a million times more energetic than a regular photon. Luckily for us, the Earth's ozone layer filtered most of the harmful radiation they carried, although astronauts had been particularly vulnerable.
I know what they are, Gabby told them. It's my field, but I don't see how that has anything...
Her gaze wandered away from the Rear Admiral's face and up to the ceiling, a habit she had whenever her mind was working overtime.
Did either of you experience any flashing lights recently?
Jack shook his head, while Gabby nodded yes. They looked at one another. The smile was back on Stark's lips.
Of course you experienced it. Remember the spike on that graph I showed you? Well, the folks at NASA started crunching some numbers and calculated the point the burst originated from, as well as how far out it reached.
Stark handed them another piece of paper. Jack stared down, his fingers feeling numb. He wasn't sure whether he felt more frightened or shocked. The picture Stark handed them showed a satellite image of the Yucatan Peninsula. Superimposed over that was an area of effect which reached as far south as Brazil and as far north as the United States. Directly in the center of the blast circle was the rig. The gamma ray explanation made sense. Jack remembered watching a program in which astronauts reported flashes of light whenever cosmic rays impacted their optic nerves. The joy drained from Stark's face.
First things first, I need to know what kind of experiments you folks are running here. After that, I've got orders to shut you down and ship you all back to the United States.
Fat chance, Jack protested. We're not going anywhere, and we didn't create any gamma ray burst.
That's too bad, Stark said, shaking his head and closing his briefcase shut with a snap.
Gabby stepped forward.
Too bad? What's that supposed to mean?
Her concern was obvious and well warranted. They were on the threshold of perhaps the greatest scientific discovery in human history, and here they were, watching it get snatched away. It was beyond infuriating.
I had hoped you two might be able to shed some light on something else the NASA folks told us.
Jack shook his head, utterly confused.
About the gamma ray, you mean?
Admiral Stark nodded.
Yes, those eggheads at NASA claim to have detected some kind of binary code embedded in the signal.
Chapter 11 Mia returned to the hotel, feeling like a sponge wrung dry. The lobby, slippery with white tiles, was empty except for a tired-looking clerk behind the desk. Mia had come to Brazil to study craniofacial anomalies in the hopes of developing preventions and perhaps even treatments that might offer hope to individuals and families struck by the genetic disorder. But
that wasn't the whole story, was it? The truth was, Mia had spent the last 4 years of her life clawing her way out of an abyss of pain pills and dark depression. The agony of hearing those words, even when they were only in her head, still seared like a hot knife. Invariably, addiction was a self-defeating condition, and on an intellectual level, she understood that now, along with the reality that the more we tried to deny the truth of who we were and what we had done, the more we empowered the negative forces which got us into trouble in the first place. It didn't help that substance abuse and the ravages of addiction had been prevalent themes in her early childhood. Earlier, she had told Scott she had quit the lab, but technically speaking, that hadn't been entirely accurate. The truth was that Alan had fired her. The two of them had had an affair, a personal tidbit she did not think was any of Scott's business. Alan was nearly 30 years older than her, and certainly not her type. But there was something about a man at the top of his game that was irresistible, intoxicating. She'd had a husband who loved her, and a daughter who worshipped the ground she walked on. What had she been missing? Clearly nothing. It had started and ended at a conference. One second, they were at the bar drinking mojitos, dreaming about the Nobel Prize for physiology or medicine, and laughing their heads off. The next thing she knew, she was waking up in his hotel room without a stitch of clothing on. The feeling had been surreal and incredibly disturbing, much like the way she was feeling now. Alan had stood over her, buttoning his shirt. "You were a naughty girl last night." His voice was deep and resonating. Mia's face had twisted with shame. What on earth had she done? A question she meant quite literally. What had happened the night before? She posed the question to Alan, who only chuckled and leaned in to brush the back of his fingers against her cheek. When she recoiled, she saw a flash of anger in his eyes. "I hope you're not going to go all bitchy on me now," he said, his normally melodic tone menacing. She felt tears struggling past her eyelids and squelched them back. "After the bar? I don't remember a thing. How we got back to your room?" She knew they'd been having a fun time, but she'd been anxious to get back to her own room to call Paul and Zoe and wish them a good night. How had it ended up like this? Alan held out a hand to help her up. She hesitated. He wiggled his fingers encouragingly. She accepted, and he pulled her onto her feet and into his arms. Mia placed her palms against his chest and pushed away as he pulled her closer to him. "Whatever happened last night," she said, finally breaking free, "was a mistake." Alan shook his head and grinned. "I remember exactly what happened." He centered his index finger over his lips. "Don't worry. It'll be our little secret." Mia felt her stomach turn in a slow, lazy circle. Alan's threat was as apparent as the tufts of hair pushing out the top of his shirt. Between the two of them, she had the most to lose. Alan's wife was buried up at Oakwood, and he was a distinguished researcher. Her entire career lay before her, while at home she had a beautiful family who waited impatiently for her return. She had thrown on the few articles of clothing she could find and ran from the room, hot tears streaming down her cheeks. The next few days had been spent trying to pull herself together. Had she suffered a serious lapse in judgment, lubricated by a few too many mojitos? Or had Alan put something in her drink? Mia never found out, but one thing was certain. She would never make either mistake again. In spite of her disturbing encounter with Alan at the conference, it was shortly afterward that she had made the breakthrough on the human artificial chromosome. The greatest challenge had been integrating DNA into the new structure. Once that challenge had been overcome, it now meant the new synthetic chromosome could be loaded with as many genes as needed. Turning that corner had been a major turning point, not only for Mia, but for the future of gene therapy. Only days later, while she'd been sitting at home watching the news one night, a story had come on detailing her breakthrough. But to her utter astonishment, Alan had been the one to call the press conference, using it as an opportunity to take all the credit for himself. Mia wasn't out for glory, but since it had been her work which had led to the breakthrough, the idea of holding a press conference behind her back felt unconscionable. Her repeated calls that night had gone straight to his voicemail. As a result, it was only the following day at the lab that she'd let him have it. But Alan wasn't the kind of man who did well being lectured by those he felt were beneath him. She'd soon found herself out of a job. That part hadn't been terribly surprising. But what came next had shocked her to the core. An anonymous email, dripping with lies, had arrived in Paul's inbox, informing him that Alan and Mia had been having an affair for years. That evening, Paul had confronted her, demanding to know if it was true. She came clean about the night at the conference, tried to explain there were stretches of time she couldn't account for, but he was convinced she was downplaying her involvement. He saw and resented how much she admired Alan, had been suspicious for months that there was more to their relationship than she was willing to admit, and now all of his concerns were proving right. He left with Zoe that very night to stay with his parents in South Carolina. 5 days later, despondent and feeling like all she wanted to do was fall asleep and never wake up again, Mia had been served with divorce papers. It was following that little bombshell that the pills had entered the picture. Oxycontin, Xanax, Vicodin, anything to hold back the crushing torment tearing at her soul. By the time she got picked up for driving under the influence and wrapping her Hyundai hatchback around a light post, Mia's life had already hit rock bottom. "Mrs. Ward?" a distant voice called out to her as she waited for the elevator. A hand touched her shoulder, and she jumped with fright. "Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Ward," the front desk attendant said, backing away. "This package came for you earlier today." He glanced down at the label. "Overnight delivery." He handed her a fat brown paper parcel with her name on it, to the care of Dr. Mia Ward. Stenciled in dark capital letters on the top and bottom was the word fragile. The white packing slip had the initials A.S. and an address in Richmond, Virginia. Mia thought of the two missed calls she'd received from Alan earlier. After everything he'd done, what possible reason could he have for sending her this package? He had to know she'd be tempted to dump it in the Amazon, so why take that chance? Whatever was going on, it had to be serious. Chapter 12. Mia hurried to her hotel room and locked the door once inside. She leaned back, the hard wood pressing into her spine. With trembling hands, Mia studied the parcel. This afternoon, after she saw Alan had tried to call her, Mia had swallowed as much of the anger and loathing as she could and dialed him back a dozen times. But each new call had ended the same as the last. Alan never answered, and she hadn't bothered leaving a message. Some sort of medical emergency was sweeping large parts of North and South America, one she didn't understand just yet. But her gut told her it had something to do with Salzburg syndrome, the disorder Alan's lab had cataloged a few years back. If speaking with a sworn enemy might help her patients, perhaps even save lives, then she was perfectly willing to bite the bullet and see what he could tell her. Bounding over to the table, she fished out a small pocket knife from her knapsack and used the 3-inch blade to slice through reams of clear packing tape. Clearly, Alan had been paranoid the ends of the envelope might tear open in transit. He must have also paid a handsome price to have it shipped overnight to Brazil. It spoke volumes, especially for a notoriously cheap guy who'd once demanded that lab technicians provide their own latex gloves. Mia finished cutting through the tape and set the knife down on the table. She froze. How was it that Alan knew she was here? Had he contacted the WHO headquarters and used his considerable pull within the medical research community to locate her? Or had one of their mutual colleagues said something, not realizing the extent of the bad blood between them? With the package now open, Mia stuck a hand inside the thick, bubble-wrapped envelope and brought out a digital voice recorder. Next, she found a notebook. Wiggling the empty envelope, Mia heard something rattling around at the bottom. Her hand disappeared inside once again, only to emerge a second later with a USB key. Certain now she had everything, she fired up her laptop and plugged the USB into the port. At once, a username and password screen popped up. She stared at it, her uncertainty quickly morphing into annoyance. This was so Alan to send her an encrypted USB. What was the point of sending her this stuff if she couldn't access it? When she flipped open the diary, two words in black marker were etched on the inside cover. Play recorder. She did as instructed. Soon, Alan's radio-quality voice filled the room, except he sounded awfully strange, speaking quickly, tripping over words, as though he had a lot to say and no time to say it in.
Mia, I need you to listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you. As soon as this recording is done, I want you to fill the sink in your bathroom and toss the recorder in. I know, I'm the last person on Earth you want to hear from, but there's no one else I can turn to. The package you're holding contains an explosive discovery that has put my life and the lives of those around me in danger. I don't have time to go into detail, but here's all you need to know. Salzburg syndrome is not what we thought it was. It was manufactured, and not by us. The chromatid's DNA holds the proof of what I'm saying. A secret message written by those who created it. Please, keep the material safe until things here cool down. I'll contact you in a few days. And Mia, above all else, trust no one.
Mia swallowed hard, her heart hammering against the walls of her chest. All the moisture in her mouth was gone. What on earth was she to make of this? An encrypted USB and a story about some hidden message inside the DNA of a rare genetic disorder. She got up, steadying herself on a pair of wobbly legs. The digital recorder was still in her hand. She headed for the bathroom, intent on doing as Alan had suggested and dunking it underwater. If he really was in danger, why would he involve her? Didn't she already have enough on her plate to deal with? It was true that at the lab he'd often called her his protege. Maybe he wasn't sure who he could trust anymore. Mia dumped the recorder in the sink and began filling it with water. It had reached the halfway mark when she heard a knock at her hotel room door. A jolt of fear sent a rippling current coursing along every nerve ending. She skulked to the door, glancing through the peephole. The man on the other side was wearing a hotel clerk's uniform, but she didn't recognize his face. After his second knock went unanswered, he scanned both ends of the hallway and produced an electronic room key, inserting it into the slot. Mia heard a click, followed by the sound of the handle being turned. He was trying to get in, but she had locked the bolt. That was when he swore and sent the heel of his boot thudding into the door. The water from the sink had begun to overflow, spilling onto the floor. Mia screamed, her feet slipping on the wet tiles as she recoiled. But the scream only served to intensify her aggressor's determination. The edges of the door began to splinter. With a burst of adrenaline, Mia threw herself forward and latched the swinging door bar, hoping that might stall him while she tried to escape. She ran toward the window, searching frantically for another exit. A sliding glass door by her bed led onto a small balcony, but her room was six stories up, far too great a height to leap off without snapping every bone in her legs, and maybe even her neck as well. Mia snatched the backpack off her bed, searching for the pocket knife. The door flew open just as her frantic mind recalled she'd left it on the table. In a panicked blur of speed, she grabbed it and made a break for the balcony. At least there, her yelling might alert the police. The man came forward, bypassing the items from the envelope she'd left on the table. He stepped out onto the balcony. Mia held the knife out between them and let out a terrible shriek. For a moment, it had the desired effect, since her assailant hesitated. Down below, a number of pedestrians stopped and craned their heads to see what was happening.
"Policia! Policia!"
she yelled, without any idea if she was even shouting words they understood. "Put the knife down and come with me," the man said calmly in broken English. He lifted his shirt, revealing the gun in his waistband.
"I don't want to have to kill you."
He continued to inch closer, one arm outstretched, the other hand on the hilt of the pistol. With every step, the real estate Mia was occupying on the balcony grew smaller and smaller.
"Get away from me!" she shouted, and lashed out with the blade, slicing a deep gash along his forehead.
The skin split with surprising ease. A gout of blood poured down his face and into his eyes as both of his hands went reflexively to the stinging wound.
"You bitch!"
he yelped in agony and charged forward in a blind rage. At the last second, Mia dropped down and watched his arms close around empty space, his torso bending over the balcony railing from the momentum. For a moment, his legs lifted into the air, and Mia grabbed and pushed upward with every last ounce of strength, watching his bulk counterbalance up and over the other side.
He fell through the air in slow motion, his arms and legs wheeling wildly. He hit the ground with a sickening crunch. Mia peered over the edge, her hands covering her mouth in horror.
Oh my God, what have I done?
Down below, a crowd gathered around the dead body. Some of them pointed in her direction. At her feet was the man's pistol, which must have fallen loose as he went over. Trust no one. Scooping the gun up with two fingers, she darted back into the hotel room, grabbed her backpack, and began stuffing it with whatever she could. In went the gun, a handful of other essentials, as well as Alan's diary and the encrypted USB. She didn't need to be a Nobel laureate to know the police might not believe her story. She had killed a seemingly unarmed man. Sure, he had kicked down the door, but she was a foreigner, and he was one of them. Trust no one. She got to her splintered hotel room door, and her British research assistant, Scott Chapman, appeared. The expression on his face changed the second he realized it was her.
"What happened?" he asked, utterly bewildered.
She blew past him.
"You have blood on your face,"
Scott shouted after her.
"If you're hurt, let me help you."
But she was gone. The adrenaline still coursing, she threw open the hotel stairway door and charged into an alley. A police car raced by, his sirens blaring. Mia had no clue where she would go, only that she was a fugitive in a foreign land. As she sprinted down the alley and onto a side street, Alan's final warning kept buzzing through her head. Chapter 13. There was only so much buffeting a man's psyche could take before he decided he was better off battening down the hatches and diving for safer waters. That was how Jack was feeling in a nutshell after his conversation with Rear Admiral Stark. Much to his surprise, the Navy had known about the downed Cuban pilot in addition to their role in causing the strange gravitational anomaly. Stark had even handed over a few details of his own, namely that the anomaly had been the precursor to a burst of gamma rays, and they had detected within said rays some kind of pattern. Stark had refused to elaborate any further, although he made it clear the scientific personnel on the rig were being evacuated. Jack had asked him for 20 minutes to speak with his crew in private. He needed to explain to a bunch of cranky scientists why their life's work was being interrupted because of a military standoff in the Gulf. Stark had agreed to 10. Everyone was assembled in the mess hall, the only enclosed room on the rig that could accommodate a group that size. Among them were scientists from an array of disciplines, plus their attending grad students, as well as the deckhands and support staff. In all, they numbered 50 men and women and one synthetic person. Jack stood before them and cleared his throat. The room was awash with rumors and rampant speculation.
"I'm sure none of you need to be told what we found. The Navy has asked us to evacuate, but not because of that."
The room erupted in a cacophony. Jack put up his hand and called for silence.
"They're under the impression the disruption we experienced was a result of a science experiment gone wrong. Everyone in the area's got an itchy trigger finger, and that burst of gamma rays didn't help the situation. The scientific directive, as outlined by the U.S. Geological Survey and DICOR, has also been put on hold. I'll therefore be recommending that all non-essential personnel be relocated to the U.S. mainland. That includes the drilling team, most of the deckhands, and any scientists and grad students who wish to leave."
"What about you?"
Dag shouted from the back of the mess hall near the serving line.
"I'm not going anywhere. I hope Rear Admiral Stark and his superiors will see the wisdom in what I intend to propose."
Gabby rose to her feet, gripping Billy Brenner's shoulder as she did so.
"You want to go into that thing, don't you?"
Jack felt his hands pull out of his pockets and rest on his hips, a subconscious posture of guilt.
"We don't know what's down there, Jack," Gabby snapped. "What if they decide to blow it up?"
Grant, seated nearby, broke into a gale of laughter.
"Gabby, you and I both know they would never do such a thing. Imagine, for a moment, an ancient Greek scientist got his hands on a smartphone. Sure, he might never be able to figure out exactly how it worked, but that certainly wouldn't stop him from taking the thing apart."
Jack turned to Anna, whose android torso had been deposited on a seat next to Rajesh. She glanced up in thought. A dispassionate search for the truth should always be a scientist's prime objective. All other considerations are secondary.
The question I have is why Dr. Bishop is so opposed to the idea.
Spoken like a true robot, Gabby quipped, retaking her seat and crossing her arms without bothering to respond. As far as Jack was concerned, she didn't need to. Gabby's reaction made perfect sense. His co-chief was witnessing an expedition she'd spent years getting off the ground rapidly descend into a steep nosedive. The frustration on her face was clear to see. So, too, was the pain. But research often led scientists down blind alleys they never anticipated. Hell, if memory served him, Jack was pretty sure Viagra had originally been developed to lower blood pressure until doctors had noticed it was raising something else.
There's no denying it, Billy said from the middle of the crowd. He was next to the other drilling engineers. The government's in a real pickle. I'm with Dr. Holland on this one. They sure as hell can't blow it up. And for the life of me, I can't see how they could scoop up something the size of Lower Manhattan out of the hole it's in.
That's assuming we tell them it's down there, Jack said. Gabby shook her head violently. He didn't need an interpreter to know which way she was leaning. The mood in the room appeared evenly split between those who were frightened and felt it should be left alone and those who were excited by the possibilities.
Anyone who wants to leave has my blessing, Jack told them. Return to your bunks, gather your things, and line up by the helipad. For everyone else, wait here.
Jack began moving through the crowd toward the mess hall doors.
Boss, where are you going? Dag asked.
To tell Admiral Stark some of us are staying, whether he likes it or not.
Chapter 14. Needless to say, Jack wasn't going to pitch it to the Rear Admiral in exactly the harsh terms he had indicated earlier. It was persuasion he was after, not a game of chicken with a guy who commanded an aircraft carrier strike group. Seconds later, he found Stark and his men waiting by the rig's busted drill. The Rear Admiral checked his watch.
I gave you 10 minutes, he said, without smiling. That was 15. Means you owe me 5.
Jack made a mental note on the spot. Remind me never to invite this guy to a party.
Your people are packing their gear, I assume? Stark asked. Once tensions in the area settle down, we'll allow the heavy choppers back in to remove the shipping containers and anything else left behind.
That's what I wanted to talk to you about, Jack said, edging closer.
You remember those gamma rays you asked about? What if I told you we weren't the ones who caused it?
The final drop of good humor on Stark's face melted away.
I'm not following you.
I'm saying we are sitting on the greatest single discovery in the history of the human race.
Stark rolled back on his heels. If I had a nickel every time one of you science types gave me that line, I'd be a rich man.
What if I told you we found a metallic structure 500 meters beneath the ocean that would make a Nimitz-class carrier look like a tugboat?
Stark paused and drew in a slow breath. I would wonder what psychotropic substances you were on.
You're the one who showed up talking about rays from space and binary codes, Admiral, not me.
What kind of structure are we talking about?
That's what we were trying to figure out when you and your men showed up.
The glare in Stark's eye grew sharp, dangerous. You better not be trying to yank my chain, because
I can prove it to you, Jack said. But first, we need to discuss terms.
Terms?
The Admiral spoke the words as though they were in a foreign tongue. A man like Stark didn't negotiate. He took orders from his superiors and doled them out to those under him. Now Jack had the advantage.
So far, we've only seen it from the outside. There seems to be an opening of some sort, but getting inside may be a whole other kettle of fish. Some of the top scientific minds in the world are on this rig, just waiting to be unleashed. That's what we bring to the table.
And what's our role in this? Stark asked, amused. The Navy's deep-sea salvage units have the equipment we need to make it there and back in one piece.
I'm not buying what you're selling, Jack.
Jack shook his head, his eyes turned to the heavens.
Oh, what a cynical world we live in.
He led Stark, Hart, and Olson to the ROV shipping container and the monitors they had used to oversee Zeus's recent dive. Jack accessed the log and replayed the most recent entry. Stark and the SEALs leaned forward, squinting at the monitor, their hands on the edge of the desk. Jack sped up the footage, rolling past the descent, slowing it down once they'd cleared the fissure. Each of the men maintained a neutral expression as the silver tip of the pyramid came into view. But they were only humans, after all. Humans who lived in a world that was well-defined and often infuriatingly mundane.
The unpredictable chaos of battle was one way some folks learned who they really were. Facing the incredible was another. After they were done, the three men remained quiet, their arms crossed over their chests, their faces ashen. Even Hart's flushed complexion had receded.
"Any second now, one of you is going to ask me what the hell that thing is," Jack predicted. "And the answer is, we don't know. What we can say with some certainty is that we didn't build it, and we didn't put it there."
"By we, you mean Americans?" Lieutenant Olson asked, sweat now beating his shaved head.
"By we, I mean humans."
Admiral Stark brought the back of his hand across his forehead, slick with sweat.
"You know, if this is real, then we can't possibly honor any agreement."
"You can," Jack insisted, "and you will, because copies of all the data we've collected so far, seismic, GPS, video, have already been encrypted and sent to a safe place. I only need to say the word, and all of it gets sent to every major news organization around the world. And if I don't check in with a password within 72 hours, the same thing happens. And try not to forget, gentlemen, we're in Mexican waters right now. I'm sure if anyone has a rightful claim to this giant tin can, it's them. And you can bet your bottom dollar the Cubans and the Russians would put up one hell of a fight to get their hands on whatever's inside. So, we can work together and get to the truth, or you can watch this pissing contest in the Gulf spiral into a real war."
"Where did you find the time to send copies of the encrypted data off for safekeeping?"
Jack twisted the knife. "I used those extra 5 minutes you gave me."
Chapter 15. Mia's boots shuffled along a wide dirt road. On either side of her were rows of two-story homes with red-tiled roofs. The sun had set less than an hour ago, and a silence had descended over the street, broken only by the distant sound of a barking dog and the cell phone that kept ringing in her pocket. Since fleeing from the hotel, she had slunk through the back streets, attempting to evade both the people who wanted her dead and the police who wanted her for murder. When her cell phone vibrated in her pocket again, she checked it, having learned from her earlier mistake. The number flashing was one she didn't recognize. She let it go to voicemail. She was still dressed in the same clothes she'd been wearing during the attack, her cargo pants and dark button-down shirt. On her feet were a pair of hiking boots, and slung over her back was a knapsack filled with two extra shirts, underwear, socks, as well as the journal and encrypted USB Alan had sent her. But not the voice recorder. That was back at the hotel, resting in a sink filled with water. Sweat from the evening heat beaded on her forehead and ran down her back. Mia wondered now whether destroying the recorder had been the right decision. The cops only had to listen to what was recorded to know she was telling the truth. She kept playing the scene over in her traumatized mind, how her attacker had kicked the door in and lunged at her on the balcony. Mia let her hand fall to the assassin's pistol, now resting in her waistband. Why hadn't he shot her? He had even said he didn't want to hurt her. A killer with a heart of gold? Or maybe Alan's research wasn't the only thing he'd come to retrieve. The memory of his body hitting the ground ricocheted inside her head. Grisly sights aside, the man's death had made one thing certain. She would never learn why he had tried to kill her. She wanted to believe the attack had been nothing more than a coincidence. Maybe it had nothing to do with Alan's research. Somehow, the idea made her feel better, but she knew it couldn't be true. Had he simply intended to rob or even rape her, he would never have brought so much attention to himself by kicking down the door. It wasn't long before the tail end of Mia's adrenaline began to wear off, and as it faded, the full impact of her mental and physical exhaustion began to hit home. Before long, the simple act of putting one leg in front of the other required a gargantuan effort. She needed to find a safe place where she could catch a few hours of sleep. Hotels, the most obvious solution, were a no-go. So too were hostels and bed and breakfasts. They would be the first places the cops would come looking for her. After that were the hospitals, and maybe even the morgue. An American embassy would have been nice, even a consulate. Heck, she wasn't picky. But either one was hundreds of miles away. Mia would need to rely on her own cunning to get to Manaus, where she could catch a flight back to the United States. Lining the dirt road were a number of parked cars. If she could find one that was unlocked, she might be able to hunker down for a few hours. The first few that she tried wouldn't open. Big surprise. Then she remembered something an old boyfriend had told her. Sean was his name. Large and muscular, with a birthmark on his cheek in the shape of Idaho, he'd been a cop with the Richmond PD. For 2 years, car thefts had been his beat. She recalled hearing him complain about how in older cars, each door needed to be locked. It had meant that often folks walked away, leaving 3 car doors wide open. So Mia began trying the handles in the back as well. She had worked her way down 3/4 of the street when the rear door on a Honda Civic swung open. Breathing a much-needed sigh of relief, Mia crawled into the back seat. The car was stuffed with fast food containers, empty wrappers, and what looked like overdue bills. Under the circumstances, she wasn't going to be picky. After removing the pistol from under her waistband, she nestled in among the trash. In a weird way, all that papery padding made for a comfortable bed, although the ghostly odor of fast food did nothing to settle the incessant grumbling in her belly. She hadn't eaten anything the entire day. And when she'd got back to the hotel, memories began to flood back in, and Mia used whatever energy she had left to hold them at bay. Stabbing a hand into her pocket, she came out with her cell phone. 15 more missed calls, most from foreign-looking numbers. Since escaping, she had fought against the overwhelming desire to call home, if only to hear her daughter's voice one last time. She knew Paul would object, maybe even lie that Zoe was sleeping. But then, another, darker realization began to hit her. What if her family was also in danger? Since the people after her had failed, what was stopping them from going after the ones she loved? Cycling through her contacts, Mia pushed Paul's number and held her breath while it dialed. After 4 rings, the voicemail picked up. Mia swore.
"Hi, this is Paul. Please leave a message."
After the tone, she rattled off everything that had happened and told him to take Zoe and head somewhere safe. She disconnected, hoping she hadn't sounded like a complete nutcase. She then wrote him an email just to be sure the message got through, loud and clear. Yesterday, the news had been in a tizzy about the blinding flash experienced by a large swath of people in North and South America. Racking up what was undoubtedly going to be a monstrous data bill, Mia began searching the major news outlets. She hoped that a determined reporter might have gotten information on what had caused the flash and whether people outside of Brazil had also been affected. 20 minutes of scrolling later, she'd found nothing useful. Most of the articles talked about the event, but stopped short of explaining what had caused it. While checking her local news in Richmond, Mia stumbled onto a link buried near the bottom of the website. The image showed firefighters dousing a flaming Cadillac XTS. The front was fine, but the rear of the vehicle was charred beyond recognition. She scanned the rest of the article with a growing sense of disbelief. Authorities say the badly burned remains of a prominent scientist were found in the trunk of his car this morning. DNA testing has yet to confirm, but police are confident that the victim is Dr. Alan Salzberg. A leading geneticist, Salzberg pioneered a number of important advances, among them the human artificial chromosome and the rare genetic disorder which bears his name. Police are treating the death as a homicide. The phone tumbled from Mia's hands, numb with shock. Now, with the terrifying news of Alan's death back in the States, one thing had become perfectly clear. Nowhere was safe. Mia was awakened by a bang and a shudder as the owner of the car started the ignition and pulled away. It was nearly dawn, the darkened sky showing hints of gray. The driver flipped on the radio, blaring a Brazilian pop song, mouthing the words and bouncing to the rhythm. Peering out from the back seat, hidden amongst the trash, she could see he was both overweight and blessed with decent dance moves. His singing voice, however, left something to be desired. She reached carefully into the waistband of her cargo pants and felt a hot flush crawl up her face. The gun wasn't there. That was right. She had removed it when she climbed in, placing it on the floor next to her bag. Mia eyed the space without finding the gun. Had it sunk beneath the sea of wrappers? The driver rifled through the debris on the passenger seat, looking for something. When he didn't find it right away, he swore and returned his attention to the road. Thankfully, the Civic was a stick shift, which required both his hands. Shifting into third, he leaned back, jamming a hand into the back seat. For a moment, his eyes left the road, swinging toward the space between the front and back seats. A blaring horn cut that short, and he jerked the car violently, rolling down his window to rattle off what Mia could only guess was an off-color expression about the driver's mother. Perhaps, having learned his lesson, he stuck with the passenger seat and the floorboard. Then, with a victorious holler, he waved a gold-colored CD in the air, kissed its shiny surface, and inserted it into the dashboard. Even worse music ensued, but on the bright side, it was loud and helped divert his attention away from her crouched form. Less than 5 minutes later, he arrived at his destination and pulled over. With a grunt, the driver got out and locked his door before moving away. The morning light painted the sky with a palette of pastels, oranges, and pinks. Tentatively, Mia raised her head and caught the driver waddling around the corner. This neighborhood, she noticed, was even more run down than the last. She flicked away the trash and found the gun resting exactly where she had hoped it would be. Shoving it down the front of her pants, she gathered the rest of her things and exited the vehicle. She locked each of the other three doors before fleeing. Unlike the residential neighborhood last night, this street was populated with large, decrepit factories. In the distance, she spotted what looked like a slum, with shacks crammed one on top of another. Mia went at a brisk pace, uncertain where she was or where she was heading. The news of Alan's death had thwarted her plan to rush back to Richmond, not with his killer awaiting her return. It was the worst kind of damned-if-you-do, damned-if-you-don't situation. She could tell the local Brazilian police what had happened, but what proof did she have to back it up? Alan had left her as the custodian of what amounted to not only his life's work, but, assuming he was right about the coded message hidden in Salzburg syndrome, perhaps the most startling discovery in modern science. Mia turned a corner and ran right into a man. She stumbled backwards. The man turned, and so did the other three who were with him. They'd been sitting on wooden crates in loose-fitting clothes, smoking cigarettes and drinking from bottles of cachaça, an alcohol made from distilled sugarcane. Mia waved an apology and quickly headed in the other direction. They catcalled and shouted after her in Portuguese. She missed almost everything apart from come back, or had it been get over here. She glanced back and saw that her four new friends were following her. Their faces turned down in scowls, they had the expressions of men eager to make their first catch of the day. Mia picked up the pace, and so did they. She entered the slum. Along the dusty streets, a handful of people moved about, perhaps getting ready to go to work. She decided to move in amongst them. Surely the men following her weren't dumb enough to try anything in front of witnesses. With every step, Mia felt the pistol dig into her pelvis, a painful feeling, but also a reassuring one. She didn't want to pull the gun out just yet, not before she really needed it. If they were also armed, it could start a gunfight in the middle of the street. Mia drew parallel with a small group of people. She began to cross the wide dirt road, intent on mixing in with the crowd. That was when she heard her assailants break into a run. Barely a few feet from the other side of the street, she pulled the pistol and spun around. The men skidded to a stop, two of them less than 5 feet away. The others were not far behind. "Take another step, and I'll blow you away," she warned, hoping they couldn't see how much her hand was shaking. The man closest to her took a step forward, testing her resolve. His features were surprisingly soft and kind, except for the scar that ran from his ear to the side of his mouth. She tightened her grip on the pistol, her finger on the trigger. The only thing she knew about guns was you never put your finger on the trigger unless you were ready to shoot. Her uncle had taught her that. She was ready. "I'm not kidding." Scarface took another step closer, and Mia squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. She squeezed again, then three more times in rapid succession, but the result was always the same. Her eyes widened with fear as the barrel of the gun sagged. The lead assailant narrowed his eyes and took one more step before a Toyota 4x4 truck struck both Scarface and his friend, launching them into the air. The men landed with a thud and rolled, kicking up clouds of dust and screams from the locals, but they weren't the only ones hit. Right as the truck had clipped their legs, the side mirror had knocked the gun clean out of Mia's hands, spinning her in a circle. A few feet away, the vehicle skidded to a stop. A man leapt from the driver's seat and fired two shots into the air. Scarface's remaining friends took off running, leaving their wounded comrades moaning on the ground.
"What are you waiting for?" the man shouted with a